Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Sprint Podcast. Again, thanks very much for all your kind comments in the last while. It's great to see people are interacting with the podcast and that you like it and you like what we're doing with it. So once again, big shout out to Dee, and actually must give a shout out as well to a couple of people that have kind of helped us out with different queries and stuff during the week. So we'll get to that in a second. Back with us again this week, we have Tommy.
Well, how's it going?
And William is here again.
How are we getting on? 9 to 9 job.
How was your week? Anything exciting? Or
I have absolutely nothing to update. Oh, actually, in big news, in outside rally news, I finally joined the world of Dirt Rally 2.0.
Ooh. You have, because I just see a lot of updates in WhatsApp groups. There is nothing better to do with fucking 10 in the morning.
How's that outside of rally news?
That's the only rally news we have. And I've been shocked and stunned when I joined the online leagues to see how far I am from any. One finishing a stage and two getting anywhere close to a decent time. It's insane.
Isn't it fair frustrating? It used to be so much more kind of easy back in the day, because all you had to beat was the preset times and on the PlayStation and Colin McRae 2 or whatever. I know you just have these cyborgs that have the stage ridden, I won't mention his name, a certain former Irish tarmac champions level of knowledge of the stage. maybe more than one guy.
I started getting suspicious that I started thinking that lads were hacking the games and typing in times into the code that they could embed somewhere, until I started doing it on one stage in Monte Carlo of all places. I took the Fabia and I said, right, I'm going to go ahead and start messing with it. And this is all on the controller. I'm still waiting for my steering wheel to arrive. So when that happens, you can just forget it. There won't be a tap done.
Do you find it better with the controller or the wheel?
No, because when I was younger, I was playing Richard Burns at the steering wheel as well. I had a Logitech wheel for that on the PS2. And that I'd say soaked up a good 5-6 years.
I've had a crack off Dirt 2 with an Oculus VR headset and, the Fanatec wheel and all. Decent rig now. It was running off a PC and all that kind of carry on. Oh my God. The Group A Impreza in New Zealand was just unbelievable. You'd actually be sweating coming out of it because, you're concentrating so hard. It's proper.
You can invest $5,000 or $6,000 in a proper setup and don't bother going rallying.
I have a Logitech wheel here, but it's an older style and it came from a certain esports champion. He used to own it, so that is very handy money. But the gear stick isn't working, but there's a mutual friend, he has a spare one down in Cork, so I'm trying to get that off him, the gear stick. When it was working, like you were saying, going into New Zealand or something like that with the H pattern, 5-5-5, just amazing. But I've tried the Oculus as well before, and that's just a different level again. But I think one thing about the growth and popularity that we've seen of Dirt Rally and Dirt Rally 2.0, it could go one of two ways. It could see a huge resurgence in the interest in rallying amongst people, or people might never bother going rallying again, just stay at home playing that.
You'd be hoping, obviously, it's the former. Obviously, Joe, we've only heard today that there's any event, with 5,000 people or more won't get a license till September. Look, obviously, we're not disputing these recommendations. They're obviously coming with the best scientific evidence or whatever. So, we'll just abide by them and do our bit to keep people safe. But, it does throw a question and throw a bit of a black cloud over rallying this year in every sport. And to be honest, it is really hard to see anything, of any kind of volume happening this year. I'd be very surprised if we saw any event take place in Ireland this year. Let alone abroad.
Which goes to the point then we were saying, like Tommy was saying about I could never see it taken over, but like look at the Solberg Championship they put on there now last week or so. There's 8,000 people registered for that.
And imagine a rally with 8,000 cows.
It's over a couple of different rallies. You can configure the championships any way you want. So Solberg's have obviously set up championship at a couple of events. It's 8,000. So like I did Sweden there today, said to give it a lash in a field of bravery. And I was like, oh, grand, nice. Just solid enough stage time. 350 or something I was on the stage. And I was like, Jesus Christ.
But Camille,
it's only slightly worse than our actual results.
Bigger entry field. Yeah.
But the other angle you could look at it with something like that is, okay, of that 7,000 or 8,000 people that are signed up for the Solberg Championship, it's fair to say a lot may be already rally competitors. So we could say, let's be very, very extremely ambitious with the number and say 1,000 people are already rally competitors. If the other 7,000, if 10%, if not even, 10% of that decided, you know, that they were interested in rallying or that they were going to join their local motor club, you know, people that might be armchair enthusiasts just looking for a way in, it's brought it back. It may have accidentally brought it back into public consciousness, the success of the game. And the fact that Codemasters were willing to put the money behind it, because there was a school of thought that there's no market for a rally game. But clearly, it's a dormant market that I think people didn't realise was there until, you know, it was put out there. And obviously, people have taken it and ran with it.
Yeah, I think they've done it in such a way as well. I think the reason it's so good, and I'm only finding this in the last week or so, is it's properly just raw rallying. It has all the aspects of the sport that we love in a game, because even like we said, the dirt games for a while, they went off in a weird American kind of block direction. I don't know, nothing against them, I think it's brilliant, but the games became very arcadey and Americanized, whereas now they're brought back to proper, dirty, rough and raw rallying with every single, like all the old cars, the way the rallies are done, long stages.
Chicanes.
Chicanes, intervals of service intervals between certain stages. The car setup is unbelievable. It's just
my own experience of driving it and without owning a rig myself or whatever, like the only kind of gripe I would have with 2.0, I don't have much experience of the first one to kind of comment on it. The tarmac physics aren't really up to scratch, I found anyway. The gravel physics seems to be pretty decent, but it's the one thing that turned me off the game is the physics. The game can look as good as it wants, as sound as good as it wants, and you know, I have all the iconic cars and stages and whatever. If the physics are wrong, my god, like if you look at the last few WRC games, yeah, they were basically unplayable. Like, I couldn't fucking go near them. To be fair, the most recent one, WRC 8, I think they've stepped up a fair bit in that regard, so that's good to see. But like you mentioned Richard Burns rally there, that's probably still, you know, still it really is, like
it's the only game where you can actually feel the weight of a car and the length of a steering rack. That's the way I'll put it. And especially on tarmac, you know, like fair enough, yeah, dirt was brilliant on loose surface and all that kind of stuff, but I agree with you on the tarmac. It's still slightly arcadey. I think that's probably where they got the balance right to get that large audience, because like Richard Burns is a very niche group of people who like it.
Yeah,
RBR
is a really hard game to, but when there's nothing better than getting a stage kind of hooked up in it, you know. But you're right that, look, to be fair, all credit to Codemasters there. They've done a fantastic job. As you said, you know, Tommy, if you can draw a few more people into the sport in a real sense, that's brilliant. Like we can talk about, we grew up with the likes of, you know, Colin McRae and Rally on the PS1 and stuff. Do you know, for a lot of people,
this Colin is the closest McRae, we've seen to it in a long time.
Yeah, back then, like Colin McRae to a lot of people was a computer game, but that was great in its own way, because it meant that, you know, rallying had transcended just being kind of a niche enthusiast only sport, and it had come into the kind of more mainstream side of things. The same like Tony Hawk and skateboarding or whatever, like And I guarantee you to this day, if someone, you ask someone in the street who has no interest in it, name a rail driver, they'll invariably say Callum McRae. So, you know, it is great to see the reaction to it again. It's just unfortunate again that it took this set of circumstances for it to grow again. But look, your point there about spending a few grand in a rig, and you know, what would you need to be? What else would you need to go competing again? I can kind of see that point of view as well, because there's an awful lot to be said on a rainy day or the middle of winter or whatever. Hop on the rig there, you can, you know, with certain games, with whatever mods they have at this stage, they're just unbelievable. You could pretty much take any car ever built on any track ever built.
Yeah.
You know, out for a spin, like, so it's not, I know it's not the real thing, but
yeah, that's
as a training tool, though. I think it helps.
Does fill the gap, right? And it's brilliant. But for anyone, and we've all had the fortune to be able to compete in the past and up to recently, nothing replaces the real thing.
No,
and it's not even about the driving, it's just that, like, we could actually do a full podcast on a full day event and go through, just you just can't beat it.
What I found with the simulator, as opposed to, I'm running mine off an Xbox One here, but I spent 5 years rallying with a driver, and in the last year or two he bought a real proper sim rig complete with the Oculus. And the night before an event, I stood up there with him, and I had to go on the Oculus and had to go with it. I noticed he only started using it a month or two at that stage. The next day, how much sharper the driver was. I didn't have to repeat a note. I wasn't asked to repeat a note because you were tuned in that fraction more. And I do think a lot of drivers are using it for that as well, to keep their mind in the more dispose of being
like
able
the time,
to
like the time listen. Like the time Gary Jennings took the S9, was it an Ulster for the first time? And the way he described it in services, he said it's just PlayStation mode. It's a good way to describe it. It's probably that gap is so much smaller now between the virtual simulation.
But it's like you say, when you go to that level with the Fanatec spec of stuff and using PCs and you know, the mods, the RBR mods and things, it's not gaming anymore at that stage. It's simulation. That's what it is. I've sat in rooms with people doing it, and their aim isn't to go as hard as they can. Their aim is to not make mistakes, so that they can incorporate it going forward. That they're not looking for a note a second time. It's to help them tune in. I think that's what some of the guys have been doing.
We'll probably do a podcast.
We could go down a rabbit hole on this. We could. That's the problem.
we'll probably do a full episode on rally games in the future. There's been some great ones. There's been some shite ones. So we'll give them all a fair go. And they were lucky enough, as I said, to either have owned or have played the majority of them at this stage, including some, you know, absolutely. So some of the joy you get kind of games on the old Nokia phones and stuff like that. They purported to be rally games, but Jesus Christ, I don't know what these fellas were smoking, but it wasn't rallying anyway, whatever they were doing. But so we'll give a look at that in the future. But anyway, just before we kind of get into the meat of the podcast, just a shout out to a couple of people there who've came back to us with some bits of info during the week. We had a couple of queries around the Zara WRCs and their kind of testing endeavours in 1999. So Keane Donlan actually sent down a very interesting article taken from an old yearbook. I think they were similar to the F1 yearbooks you could get back in the day. They're brilliant books now. I don't actually know who wrote the article, but it explained a fair bit. And Gerard Nyhan as well on the Gravel Crew group, he sent down a video of the car actually testing, which is very interesting to watch. The first kind of, I suppose, real test of the Zara WRC. It was in a plain white livery, and Just cool to see. The thoughts at the time were that the Zara wasn't actually going to become a world rally car and go compete. That there was thoughts that it would just end up in a museum and that would be that, which would obviously be extremely interesting to see what would have happened in rallying over the following decade if Citroën hadn't come in like that. But it's just one of those interesting stories. So shout out to the lads for spotting that. Yeah, so just looking at kind of a recap of where we are with the season to date, Obviously, we had the first four loans based in Europe. Argentina was going to be the first of their long haul events, and the man for the first four events really was Tommy. As we said, kind of at the end of Catalonia, you know, it's going to be very hard to look past them at this point in the season. You would have put a fair chunk of money, you know, on him getting to the end and being on top. But like the likes of, we'll say, McRae, Granholm, Burns, they had absolutely shambolic starts to the season for various reasons. McRae had 0 points on the board at this stage. Like nothing going into Argentina. So that's four. Basically, he was starting his season in Argentina, if you want to put it that way. Like there was nothing good to show for the first four rallies between reliability and his own errors, although predominantly the former. Granholm was having a nightmare of a season as well. Had just come off, you know, his championship win in 2000, and just various issues with the car. He'd made mistakes as well. He'd put the car off in Spain, and was just having a terrible, terrible defense to his title. It was already looking as if he was out of the equation. He'd almost. Marcus is a very, you know, interesting character. Like, he was always very humorous in his interviews. It seemed like he was almost resigned even at this stage of the season to say that, nah, I'm pretty much done here. This is a bit of a write off. You know, it's just interesting to see someone not throwing the towel, but you know, kind of have that mentality. Whereas you could see with McRae and Burns, they still, you know, they'd probably been they'd been around a bit longer, kind of at the top level than Granholm had, and they were kind of they were used to the long game, I suppose. But even then, you know, being 26 points behind Mäkinen after four rallies, I wouldn't envy anyone that task to try and make that up.
Even on that point, Morris, just like I know we mentioned in the last podcast about Peugeot. Like, if I was Granholm, I'd be far angrier, more vocal if I had a season that bad, mainly because of the car.
We don't know what was happening behind closed doors. If there was issues there, I don't know. You know, Marcus always kind of struck me as a guy who was, you know, fucking phenomenal talent. You know, one of the quickest guys around that era. Like, and he really gelled with that car. But especially the 2000, it kind of struck me a bit like he was almost surprised to win. You know, it was his first championship, but it was kind of a breakthrough year for him or whatever. But yeah, maybe he didn't have the clout of a McRae or a Mäkinen. You know, maybe he didn't have.
Look at it this way. If you look at, let's say, the transition period from the PSA group, and I know everyone says they're independent, but they're not. They're coming from the same wallet. So you had all the money that was going in to develop the Zara, both the kit car and the WRC one. Then you had them coming in pretty much as Peugeot were. I'd say, no, they had a good year in 2002, but just, we'll say, almost at the end of, like, trying to phase the Peugeot team out, ramp the Citroën team up. Like, you saw basically Peugeot were pretty much gone in 2003. And then that was Citroen domination from that point on. So you wonder, was there already a shift in focus from the PSA group in terms of development?
Peugeot had obviously a brilliant year in 2000, the championships. 2002 was the same. They ended up dominating 2002. But 2001 and 2003, it was just completely opposite. You know, it was like night and day with them. And in 2003, there was talk at the time that there genuinely was part supply issues that were causing a lot of the reliability problems with the Peugeot, with the 206 at that stage. 2001 could have been a similar, I suppose, story. And you'll see Ariel was probably more vocal about the issues at the time. I don't think he was happy in the team, though. There was a very strange atmosphere with him in the team back then.
He seemed quite willing to pass blame.
He was, yeah, which is, it's unusual. You know, it was probably more prevalent back then. You probably had drivers speaking their mind a little bit more back then, mm-hmm. you know, compared to having to toe the party line that little bit tighter these days. But even this age of the season, he just come off, you know, a great rally in Catalonia. He definitely wasn't, there was something up there. Like, and as we've mentioned a couple of times, he was an extremely fussy guy to work with. So maybe that wasn't, you know, maybe, although, you know, Peugeot as a team were extremely thorough in, you know, in the design of the car. The car was lightning quick. Obviously, you know, without the reliability issues, they probably would have been There's every chance they could have been at the top of the fields in both drivers and manufacturers at this stage of the season, purely on pace.
I think Auriel, at this stage of his career, he was used to being number one to a certain degree, or having joint number one status at Toyota with Sainz. Like in 99, he ran Mäkinen quite closely for the title. In 2000, he ended up at SEAT being the senior driver. It's quite apparent, or to me it looks quite apparent, that he's not the number one driver, or he wasn't, sorry, the number one driver at Peugeot in 2001. Now, that's a culture shift for somebody who was probably one of the main focuses of the team's title push before, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And Granholm was definitely the number one of Peugeot. I'd say even before he'd got the title, like they mentioned the Dirtfish podcast, which is worth a listen, by the way. If you're looking for another couple of podcasts to listen to, there's some very good ones there. They mentioned that the circumstances around him getting the Peugeot drive, and his approach. You know, you had Delacour and Panizzi kind of squabbling between themselves. At the time, both very quick guys, but there was always a bit of bad blood between those two guys, especially, you know, towards the end of Delacour's time with Peugeot, with the whole Panizzi Ricky crack. But you know, Granholm just capitalized on that. Also, you know, Panizzi was hopeless on loose surfaces, and Granholm was obviously the quickest of the three, and he was, as we've seen, very quick on tarmac as well. In certain cases, so he was able to take over the lead of the team pretty quickly. As you said, they're already coming into that. You know, he might have assumed he was going to be the team's focus, but it didn't prove to be the case. So, yeah, just an interesting one to see. Mitsubishi's performance to this point in the season was, you know, pretty impressive, considering that they'd acknowledged that the car was at the end of its life. We've mentioned already that they were pushing really hard to win the title with the Group A car as a kind of a final, kind of a, you know, send off for it, before they switched to the WRC car. But that, you know, it's still a great performance, and I suppose Tommy was the main driver of that. Subaru were having a shocking year today as well. They really needed to get their act together.
Yeah, because even with, like, I know they pretty much had Burns. I know Martin was kind of on the wheel. I know the team was relying heavily on Burns. Solberg was still very inexperienced. Like Mitsubishi, they were pretty much relying on the one driver, but there was stuff that was happening that just, you'd say, you would not like to be back in ProDrive.
I think as well, Subaru and ProDrive, back from, I suppose, the late 90s onwards, they were always pushing the envelope in terms of technology. Like, you've seen later seasons, they even brought in active suspension. In, I think, was it the S9 or the S10? I can't remember.
Yeah, San Remo and 03, they ran it. Yeah,
on the S9. And, like, they were the first to run with the fly-by-wire gearboxes, semi-automatic boxes, back to the Group A days. A lot of their undoing sometimes has been the fact that they've been pushing the envelope. In terms of technology, and I think the car was reputed to be heavily based on the P2000, but in obviously the 44S or S7 shell. You're onto something there with him in what you're saying, though, right? That there was a heavy reliance on one driver to try and bring back the success. But
can I change that? Not one driver, the number one driver. Remember who we're talking about earlier.
Yeah, okay.
On that point, Morris, just before I go on from that, just we're talking about Subaru and Burns and things. You were saying about, like, McRae's bad start, Granholm's bad start. Like, it was very hard to see Burns' season come together at this point when he came in to this. He finished this event in sixth on 9 points. So we're, what, four or five events in?
Five events after this one, yeah.
And
yeah.
Burns was on 9 points. So it was hard to see his ear shaping up from here.
It's just the nature of the season as well. Like, Monty was always the lottery. We saw that with McRae nearly getting the win in the Monty. Like, you know, that would have been really unusual for him. Sweden, was still back then, and, you know, still is more or less to this day, the preserver of the Scandinavian specialists. Portugal was just, you know, the first two or three cars on the road had a chance there. It was just a freak. It was a freak sort of event in that case. I'd say if the weather had been kind of more traditionally good in Portugal as it generally was, it would have been a totally different event in terms of the standings. And Catalonia then is obviously going to favour the Michelin and shod the French cars. So you're heading into this part of the season now where it's kind of the events that definitely suit the Pirelli tyres a bit better than the tarmac and the earlier events. You've got four really rough events coming up with this. You've Cyprus, the Acropolis, and the Safari. And these are events where Burns and McRae would have traditionally done pretty well. Burns had won in Argentina the year before, and he'd...
The last 2 years?
No, he was second in 99. There was a bit of controversy around that at the time. He'd won on the road, but there was a 10-second penalty there for some reason. I think he had gearbox issues or something. And Kankinen actually ended up getting the win. There was a bit of fuss at the... See, Kankinen, there was an interesting one. Kankinen hadn't had a win since 94, I think, at this stage. Am I right in saying that? 94, 95, around that era. I don't know, was there team orders at play or whatever, but it turned out Kankinen ended up actually beating him on the last stage and taking the win. No, Burns would have won without the 10-second penalty or whatever, but I think there was a famous quote by Robert Reed. There was obviously a bit of bad blood at the time. Where does a fin? There's a shark. So they obviously weren't too happy with Kankinen at the time. But Burns had shown, and he'd done really well in 97. It was kind of one of the first events that Burns showed, you know, proper rally winning pace. I think he'd suspension failure that year that caused him to go. But, you know, he had shown that this kind of event suited him.
Is that the event where he talked about where Kankinen came up and stuck his head in the window?
I think it was, yeah. I think just to kind of give him a bit of encouragement to say, you know, okay, you might not have got this one, like, but keep the head up, you get there.
No, I think it was I remember in the book, I don't know if it was in Argentina or one of the events where whatever time control, the Burns came in and setting mad times, and Kankinen came in and stuck his head in the window and said, you'll be world champion.
It could have been Finland, possibly, because Kankinen won Finland in 99 and Burns ran him to within 7 or 8 seconds, I think, in the end.
No, this was earlier. This was Burns in the Evo.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I think it could have been
given in it. Yeah, but look, as I said, you know, you make the point there about would they have been, you know, obviously it wasn't an ideal start to the season for the majority of people. But I don't think Burns was as downbeat as he might have been, as maybe McRae or that's what's Granholm at this stage.
That's down to his character as well. Burns was incredibly mentally strong.
He was. He showed, you know, fierce determination in the car, and you can see your frustration creeping up sometimes. But yeah, he was a hard enough man to rattle McRae as well. You know, a lot of it was made at the time that they were fierce enemies and all this kind of stuff, but that wasn't really the case. That was definitely something that was played up in the media, that the two boys hated each other, but it definitely wasn't the case in real life. There's a brilliant interview in Rally XS from the period where they actually interview each other. I think it's before the Sunday or that year.
I have it here. It's actually, it also features in Autosport, did a McRae special book. It's available, I believe, still. I still get it. I think it goes for about 4 or 5 pages. It's very, very good.
It's wonderful. Yeah, it's just really, yeah, really. It's funny. It's, you know, it just.
I think, well, like, what's good about it is, like you said, people have this idea that they built up the whole image of the rivalry and the tension. But you remember, like, they were competing and had cross paths for, you'd be talking 15, 16 years at that point. You know, like, you'd always forget the early days when they're both back. Even obviously McRae was going up a lot quicker, but you know, they would have known each other from events. Like, you picture all the lads, even like we know, like how we all got to know each other through competing. how quickly you become good friends with lads through the sport, you know.
I don't know what you're on. I can't stand it. Who you?
I'll edit that out. I hate you.
Sorry. To be honest, most people that met me had burned me anyway, so it's all gone.
Yeah, that's why Tommy wears his race suit at all times.
I also wear my fireproof boots as well, because in case you're in a nightclub and someone catches fire, you just kick the fire out.
Yeah. They definitely come in use at some point.
Yeah.
Are you in Dave?
Yeah, but just look, the other teams in as well. Skoda had a reasonably decent start to the year in the Monte, and you know, they kind of settled into their usual kind of pattern after that. And Hyundai had the new accent over Portugal, and it showed to be an improvement to the Evo 1, but still not at, you know, anywhere near rally leading pace or anything like that. Obviously, Citroën had come into Catalonia and blown everyone away. But they weren't to be seen again for another good few rallies, so we'll park them there at that. So at this stage of the season, like as we keep saying, it'd be very, very hard to look past Macadam, and it's just funny to watch how the points system went down, or the points situation developed during the year. It was almost like a championship that nobody wanted to win, you know. it's a strange one, like to see how many mistakes were made, or how many silly, you know, problems cost people good results and rallies that might have given the championship a bit earlier, or given a bit of a bigger advantage or whatever. But
there's a lot to be said for the old 10 points for the win, 6 points for second, and no super rally. There is a lot to be said for it 100%. In some regards.
Like, it'd be nice to go through that championship year. You'd take that this year as an example and put the current point system on it.
Hmm. When did super rally come in? Was it 2006?
2004 or 5, I think.
Was it?
Hang on now, let me think. 6 is the... Oh, it was the year that Loeb fought back to second in Monte Carlo with the Super Rally. I have it in my head that it was introduced...
I think 2004, Tommy, I think you're right.
I think it was 2004 because... But I don't think they could score points or something. I'm not sure. There was some... Or the penalties were bigger. There was something about it, because I remember the Mitsubishis, the first of the... I remember seeing somewhere that they were having to super rally regularly.
Oh, yeah, the first, the 0-4 lenses, yeah.
Could be wrong.
It's just funny, I suppose, at the time, you know, even with, you know, rallies with fairly high attrition rates through the works cars, you still had, well, not always, but generally, you still had Wox cars filling most of the top 10, which just shows the sheer level of them that was around back then. Whereas if you look at, you know, the end of the decade, you know, 2010 was a new decade or whatever, but you need two Wox teams without Super Rally in some events, you might have had two or three Wox cars finishing, like, which was just a pitiful situation. Like, I mean, if you would, I've made this point before. If you told someone, you know, talking in a ditch in 2001 at any rally, like, and you're watching these 17 or 18 Wox cars fly past, and the competition is massive and there's huge buzz around it, and the telly is brilliant, and, you know, everything is just going up and up and up for the sport. If you told them that by the end of the decade, there'd be two Wox teams left, one guy was after winning fucking every championship in the last few years, they'd actually look at you like you'd three heads, not least for the fact, you know, not least because you'd somehow managed to go into the future and tell them. But you know what I mean? Like, it was such a drop off, and obviously there was numerous factors. Like, there was,
but the sport was in such a level of growth as well at that stage too. And like you said, you alluded to it. It had almost crossed in. It wasn't mainstream, but it was on the fringes.
Well, yeah. Let's even without jumping too far ahead. Like, obviously, from 08 onwards is when it really just tanked. But even before that,
the rut was starting before that.
It was getting fairly shite before that. Let's call
like
it
2006. There, like, you know, if you look at the drop off in Wox teams from 2005 to 2006, you were left with Ford and Subaru in like an official capacity. Obviously, Citroën did the Cronus Racing running the Zaras, and they were a factory team and all, but DM really. But still, you know, Skoda and Mitsubishi and Peugeot disappeared even at that stage. And this was like, sure, maybe, I know, we can always talk about Ireland, but the mid-2000s was just party time with the fucking boom. So, you know, and the world economy was obviously in a much better shape than it was at the end of the decade as well. So it was just weird, you know. Obviously, Suzuki came in 2007, but that was a bit of a waste of time for them. They only lasted one full year and they were gone again.
But I'd say Will mentioned in the last podcast in terms of cost capping and motorsport, you know, two things not being mutually exclusive. This is why I suppose up to around 2003, you kind of hold as being the golden period. Also because the cars were, within reason, they were still relatable to the road going product within reason to a point. But also, it was after 2003 that they brought in the two driver rule, that their teams were capped at running two cars, and like the strain that put on, you know, the human resources that we see here, 15 works drivers out in this event, and say from 2003 onwards, you're down to maybe 8, 10.
Yeah, and then towards the end of the decade, I remember like Rally Ireland 2009. I think I actually ended up watching a clip of that just out of pure curiosity lately.
Do you find it depressing a little bit? Oh,
man. I know,
you know what's even more depressing? I missed both events.
Did all that, man? You actually didn't miss much.
But no, everyone said that, but...
I've seen more WRC events outside of Ireland than country.
That's the sad thing about it, actually, have.
Right. We'd probably, look, again, this is something I can probably do a podcast on in the future. We'll save it for then. But... it was great to have the events over here and whatever, but I remember coming away from both of them not being massive, especially 2009, but obviously there was circumstances outside everyone's control at that stage with the financial crash and whatever. And you know what, it pains me to say it, but we could be looking into something pretty similar here now at the moment. Not trying to fucking depress anyone any more than might already be the case, but we've had a pretty spectacular run there since 2017 with those new cars. I just have a feeling it's even before this happened, 2020 with Citroën dropping out, the Monty this year didn't give me the same buzz in Sweden as they did last year or the year before or whatever. So I just
look. People can rant and rave about how good the new regulations are. The new regulations are exciting. There is no doubt about it. Post 17 regs have been phenomenal in one regard. But the true test of it is, where's the queue of manufacturers that want to get involved? When one comes out, the house of cards comes down. And that's exactly what happened before. It's a cyclical thing that seems to happen within the sport. When it gets into any shape of health.
I agree with you, and that's why, like, I know people give out and they're giving out the new regs coming out. Unless you're willing to adapt and change, you're going to be left sitting there wondering, oh God, this is misery.
But
you're not going to draw manufacturers in.
But to be honest with you, there's rallying, we're going on a complete tangent here, but look, let's
Dave Daly, he's complained about our tangents before, so I'd like to just dedicate this one to him again.
Yeah, we're calling this daily divergence.
Daily's daily divergence. Nice. Yeah. Nice. I like that.
Yeah. Don't ever give us feedback again, Daily.
Triple D.
Anything negative that our friends say to us, we'll
become a feature.
Yeah, Daily.
Rallying has never been required to be like Formula One. It doesn't owe it to the world to be like Formula One or to fall into the same box of doing things like Formula One. And in terms of, say, we're potentially going into a climate now where finances are going to be stretched a little bit. Hybrid technology, all well and good, and trying to apply it in rallying is going to require a lot more investment again. There's already a category there now. It's probably a slightly watered down category when you compare it to the current regs. But R5, if you were to stretch R5 out a little bit and give the cars a 38 to 40 mil turbo restrictor and allow them to have more power than grip, you already have several manufacturers there with ready-made cars to go in there. All the manufacturers have to do is stick their name to it. They don't have to go and put massive capital investment behind it. If they have to go down the road of brand new rigs, hybrid technology, at the end of the day, rallying, it's about showing something that's relevant to the road. The engines are never going to be the same as what's on the in the road car anyway. So
I mean, look at it this way, right?
And the body shell is really what sells it.
But look at it this way, right? From the FIA's perspective, you're the governing body. Your job is to govern the sports. Keep all the rules and regulations in place, give it a roadmap and all that kind of crack. What do you do if you don't keep constantly changing and changing, pivoting, changing direction? You sit there and people start wondering what you're actually doing.
I don't agree with it, I'm just saying the cyclical thing is a kind of an interesting observation. And just to your point, Tommy, on the F1, like rallying doesn't need to be like F1. The great irony, especially about this era, was that a lot of the driver of the improvements in the coverage and stuff at the time were driven by a desire to be almost a little bit more formulaic and appealing to the mainstream public. So even though it turned out to be a hindrance in latter years, it was just a nice happy medium at this point. But if you look at, like, going back in history, Group C got huge in terms of endurance racing. That was killed. They basically costed it out of existence because it was threatening F1 at the time in terms of popularity and stuff. Group E, there was obviously multiple factors that led to that demise, the demise of Group E. But again, it was becoming massively popular. It was never really officially talked about in terms of, you know, was it a factor in the cancellation of it? But we all know who was the head of FISA back then, Balestra. We all know the decisions that were made around then. It could have been a factor, right? Rallying was extremely popular at this time. Could you say it was becoming a threat to F1? It's hard to call. F1 was going through its own kind of strange period at this point. The Ferrari dominance was just taking off around this point. And like, I fall in love out of love with world championship sports, you know, almost as they're in a cyclical fashion as well. The World Endurance Championship in recent years was brilliant for Audi and Porsche and Toyota and whatever we're betting it out. Now it's just down to Toyota again. Was it becoming a threat to F1? Hard to call, but I haven't had interest in F1 since probably the V10 days, to be brutally honest, right? And I don't mind saying it. I fell out of love with the WRC for a long time. Like, I'm talking the mid-2000s till pretty much till the new car, till the 2017 cars came in. The level of interest, I mean, the really, you know, fanatical kind of obsession with what was happening in every event, and, you know, the way we can look back at this 20 years after it happened or whatever and still have the same level of enthusiasm as we have for it, and you know, the knowledge that's just in our heads because we were so into it. Like, that's only returned to me with the advent of the 2017 rigs, you know, seeing that level of competition, seeing cars that were properly spectacular, like the 1.6 WRC cars, you know, between 2011 and 2016, they were grand. They didn't really do a huge amount for me either.
Around the 2013 point, that's when I kind of found myself really drawn. I was going and attending the WRC events at that stage, and they were great, but it was around 2013 point that I kind of really got back into it, because you had a few manufacturers involved at that stage. You know, Hyundai were on the cusp of coming back, and you had Citroen were there, you had Ford, Volkswagen were involved. You know, there was a good level of competition there, you know.
Yeah, I think that's probably the only thing that sparked up for me again was when Volkswagen came back in, and they came back in with a proper like old school work style entry into commitment into the season.
Yeah, VW really did a number on everyone for those years.
But it was brilliant, because it just showed that if you're going to do motorsport properly as a manufacturer, that's the result.
Yeah, and it's another probably debate that could be had is if VW hadn't pulled out prior to 2017. They had the car running earlier, the 2017 car, the proposed car, running a good bit earlier than everyone else. Do you know?
And you've seen the testing videos from Wales of that.
Yeah, it's lunacy, like, yeah. But I just wonder, would we be looking back at the last 3 years or so with the same fondness? Because they were built. Again, we'll probably look at these in future podcasts. As we said, we've been to a couple of the world rounds recently, and we can give kind of an in-depth kind of analysis of those. But anyway, no, that's probably the biggest tangent we've ever gone on. I'd say
we've loads of content there that if we actually wanted to recycle it, we could do that.
Do you want to just stop the podcast here, or do you want to, like, do you know what? Everyone just go and watch Argentina and make your own minds, actually. No, I'm joking. Anyway, yeah, we better get into it now because it's no.
Start the rally.
The what?
We'll start the rally.
We haven't even done the preview of the rally.
Yeah, I started off with a season recap of 2001, and we somehow ended up discussing the FA.
We got very political about this.
We started the championship like Richard Burns halfway through. Come on.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's
start the rally on day three.
Okay. Let's do an event overview before we go into it. So.
Yeah. So okay. Yeah. So this is Argentina. The first long haul event, the first round out of Europe, and the only round at the time that was held in the Americas. Based in an area called Cordoba, which is kind of around the foothills of the Andes, and their classic rallying terrain down there. The stages are pretty high in terms of altitude. They were, before Mexico came in, they were the highest, which brought its own challenges in terms of I suppose the reduction of power in the cars and things like that, and thinner air meant that they couldn't get as much power, the engines and things like that. The stages themselves were quite varied, actually. You had some really quick, smooth sections kind of on the flats, and then as you went higher and higher up the hills, it gets really rocky and kind of not muddy but, you know, really rough and rutted. Mad passionate spectators as well. It just seems to be a trend in the Latin regions, I suppose, and a huge following for signs over there as well. Obviously, as a Spanish speaking driver at the time, he was probably their closest thing to a home driver, if you want, in the top level of the sport. But looked like a brilliant event to be at.
Yeah, rally made up of 21 special stages, culminating in 389 stage kilometers, 65 entries in the rally, 17 in Class A8, with 15 works cars, with one WRC car for a privateer, which was Mark Blasquez in the Seat Cordoba World Rally Car, the Evo 3 version of it, and another Evo 3 rally car, but a Group A one, Mitsubishi, run by a local man, Martin Galiskis. I think I got that wrong. Anyway,
okay. But, the intention was there. Fair play.
Yeah, the intention was there. I wrote it down, just, you know.
Yeah. Was that a home built joke? A home built kind of an A8 kind of a thing, or was it? It was hardly an X Works car, because as we know, rally art, they were the way they ran. I think they were like an R&D. Technically, they were like an R&D setup. They couldn't. Yeah. They weren't actually allowed to sell their cars to privateers, which is why a lot of them ended up getting scrapped. Which is a pity.
Just tax reasons, wasn't it, or something like that?
There was some kind of legal thing there, which is why you. I don't think you did they ever until the 0405 cars came in.
I believe there was a program though for privateers within a certain way, where I think it was Meadows Elliott, I think, had something to do with
satellite setup.
Something like that, I think. I've read something about there lately. So there were some Group A cars, but there wouldn't be rally art ones.
Yeah. I just remember Eamon Boland had a step 2 WRC in 2004 for two rounds. In the Irish Diamond Championship, and it was just horrific. But to see, you know, there was obviously some loosening of the rules with him at that stage. But interesting one. Anything else interesting on the list?
Of the other 48 entries that made up the rally, 31 of them were in Class N4, which were predominantly Group N local drivers. There was 8 in Class N3, which was mostly Seat Ibiza's Group N. Up 1.8 Seat Ibiza's, one Peugeot 306, one Brave Soul,
5 in Class A7 with two very notable cars. One Peugeot 405 MI16 and yes. One Renault 18 GTX.
Oh my God. And it, like, the 18. You
know you're in the Americas.
Yeah, that's an old car, definitely.
But you know what? I think, like, there's something I saw when I was there. It's, they're big on kind of, we'll just call them shy cars, right? They'll drive around in, and it's just mad how these things go along the road. Like, there's a big culture of just Halfords cars. Like, do you know, you see the cheap stuff on cars here? Just draw crappy cheap mods from some 17-year-old.
Rosary beads around.
They take it to the next level of crap. No, I'm talking about my unbelievable experience there last year.
Is that publishable?
Oh, it's all publishable.
Yeah. Is it? We'll get to that in a second. But that 405, interesting one. I wonder, like, I know Peugeot Sport ran them in Group A prior to the 306 for a short period. I know that. I think it was Andrea Ghini.
Was that mostly on tarmac, Morris?
It was in Italy. They would have done a few gravel events as well. I think they even had a four-wheel drive version, a non-turbo four-wheel drive version as well, which is just an interesting kind of an anomaly. Andrea Ghini and Zanussi as well, who, if my memory serves me right, is the same Zanussi that may or may not, the name may or may not be on the dishwasher or fridge in your kitchen. So that's just an interesting kind of side note there. But yeah, so someone is trying to drag a 405 and a Renault 18 around the tough stages. So fair play to them for trying anyway. But yeah, in terms of the stages themselves, as you said, William, you've been there, have you?
Yeah, so roughly, you know, I'm trying to think of it. Oh, it's September last year. I was away and my gallivanting around the world. I spent a couple of months in South America, and obviously being in Argentina, I wasn't going to let this opportunity pass me by. So we spent a couple of days in Cordoba, so I managed to sneak my way into a rental car shop and rented the fastest cars in the world, which is a little nice little 1.6 hatchback. I can't remember what it was. I think it was a Toyota or something, whatever weird version I have over there. Drove out from Cordoba to Villa Carlos Paz, which is majority of the base that Argentina has used for the last couple of years. And headed for El Condor, Mina Clavero. And holy shit. Even if you watch the stage on TV or you watch the onboards, it doesn't even come close to showing how rough, how terrifying, and just how unbelievable the whole landscape is up around those stages. There was points there, and this, the car was high enough, but there was times where we were wedged solid on the road. I had to get out, push the car off rocks. We come over the kind of the famous Argentina bridges where Elvin Evans lost his win. What year? 2017, was it?
Yeah.
Or 2016. All those. I don't know the same stage, but you know the bridges I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But I remember, like, one thing about El Condor, like, that it was nearly impassable. It was actually terrifying. There was times where I was there and I was driving over it, and I was kind of thinking, going, why in the name of Christ am I into this sport? This is absolutely mental. Yeah. So, and I had my poor unfortunate girlfriend in the passenger seat holding the GoPro to make sure she didn't miss any second of it. So I have the footage there somewhere, but I bored her to death. So we got through it, and we went down then and did Mina Clavero. Mina Clavero is even better, I think, because you start off the stage, and it's almost like you go back down into a valley, because you kind of see all the way down through it, and you have all your drops off the edge, but all the time you're working your way down into this kind of like the lunar landscape, and you really feel like you're in a bowl, but it's just, and there's still some kind of markings and things from the rally over the years. I stopped and I got a cool photo off like near one of the bridges where there's like a sign painted, some guy obviously selling some or hustling some kind of drinks or something at the rally, and whatever way is it painted. But it was an unbelievable experience. I think if anyone, some lads would have had the chance to go watch WRC events and stuff, but if you got a chance to get road books or maps and go drive some proper WRC stages, you see how mental it is. The step up from even European level or national level is just something else.
Did you drop back the car with not only a full tank of fuel, but also a full sump of oil?
Yeah, I felt like Johnny Knoxville. I returned it with a full tank of gas, or the original Jackass movie. I'm not going to lie, the car was in shit. Let's call a spade a spade, and it doesn't matter because it was a year ago in Argentina, so that rental company, I won't name them, but haha.
All I have this image of you parking the car back in like Ace Ventura.
Yeah.
Like a glove.
I remember bringing it back because it was a bit of a spin. It's about an hour and a bit back up to Cordoba and stopping into petrol station to fill it up. And I said, fuck, I'll give it a wash now and just get all the dirt and dust off it. Everything underneath was bent. Everything. I remember opening all the door jams, trying to wipe down all the door jams with tissue paper. And I was like, geez, they'll know I flabbed this thing if they see all this.
It's like the rental cars are on the rubber ring and stuff with the all of spotters or the companies on the track to make sure you're not going out taking your Octavia or whatever on the door handles 5 minutes after you drive over the rental car place. But they might have to do the same over there. But geez, it's an event I'd love to get to. Obviously, it's logistically slightly tricky, to say the least, to get over there. But it just looks brilliant. It's unmistakable. You know, some other events in Europe, you know, they can look a little bit similar, but you definitely couldn't mistake Argentina for anywhere else. Like as I said, the kind of lunar-esque landscape, especially in the higher parts of the stages and things like that, just looks class. And obviously the support over there is monumental, like, you know, for a pretty remote region.
And that's it. Even the town, Villa Carlos Paz, like, you drive into that town and it's like, I won't name any small towns in Ireland because someone might get offended, but you know, like a little shitty arse nowhere town, and then you can just imagine what it's like when the rally comes through there.
But yeah. I think that could be said, though, the places where this sport seems to thrive worldwide, you don't really have a lot more options because they're in generally remote enough areas, you know, like that's because it's the same thing was seen with the Circuit of Ireland back in the 80s here. We didn't have options. You had two channels on TV. You barely had a landline phone, you know, so what else would you do when the rallies come to town? Everyone goes to watch.
You're showing your age there, Tommy, because I was never old enough when the circuit was a practice.
I wasn't either. That's the thing I'm only talking about from what I've been told in the video footage we've seen. But
yeah.
Because I'd love to have been old enough to have seen it. That's the thing. Yeah.
As you said, like, there's probably a huge... or an exciting event, like, you know, as I said, there wasn't much else going on. All of a sudden, you had these supercars passing your front door, or whatever. It must have been pretty cool. But yeah, so just looking at kind of how things were shaping up for the different teams going into the event, Mitsubishi had done a lot of testing in Cyprus in preparation. They'd obviously, you know, they were testing for the Cyprus event itself, but they'd worked in some of their Argentina setup. Into the work as well. Looking, Mackin had won Argentina before, yeah. Sainz had won it as well, and Oriel, Burns obviously had as well. McCrea had never actually won Argentina
at this second point. In 97.
And he had that famous incident in 98 where he bent the back right of the Impreza and was straightening his suspension arm with he ended up straightening with a boulder, wasn't it? And the car was clearly still not driving straight. Like, I mean, the wheel was still, there was still a fair toe open it, and he went down in set quickest time on the following stage, which kind of tells you everything. If you just, one of those McCrea stories that you can kind of tell, and it'll give people an understanding of just how crazy.
Dying off it for years if you did it.
Yeah, it's just crazy guy kind of attitude, and obviously won him huge support. As I said, Sainz was massively popular over there as well. Just before we get into the meat of the event, this week's podcast is sponsored by Uruguay Meat, Wine and Cheese, as seen on Gustavo Trelles, whatever, can't pronounce it. And his Evo. So shout out to Art McCarrick for pointing that out and brokering the deal. Fair play to you. So,
do we get a discount for our cabin delivery? No,
we're getting a delivery, lad. We're getting a.
Are we?
Yeah. Well, no, we're not.
No.
I wish. Good old cheese.
We're still waiting on the Wellingtons, like, you know.
I know that. Yeah. And you're sure the other fellow took all of the sunglasses for himself. So, yeah, sure. Look. And we can't go to Finland for Harry's freaking lawnmowers. So, who sponsored us in Monty again? So long ago now, I can't remember.
Was it not Valtra?
Veltra. Yeah. Let's see. Yeah. Look, we'll.
Veltra keeping the country running. That's.
Yeah. No. Spot on. But anyway. Yeah. So look out for your cheese board. It's hard to be an old cheese board and a glass of red wine there. Good stuff. But anyway. So day one. To kind of kicked off on the previous, the Thursday even, as was often the case in the events. There was two kind of super specials on the Thursday even, and then they were just kind of the usual, you can't really win a rally in a super special, but you can sure as hell lose it. But everyone got through them in reasonable condition. So it was into the Friday morning then, and I think there were 6 stages on the Friday.
Yeah, 6, yeah, because two on the night before, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was fog on the early stages as well.
There was, I think Tommy got cut out worse than most in the fog. He was obviously first on the road owing to his championship position, and he suffered the most from it. But the story, the major story of day one is McRae. Jesus, he was on some mission.
Yeah, I think he pretty much won the event from Friday.
He did, like, it was a classic McRae tactic, was to kind of, you can count numerous events where he took this approach, go out and just absolutely wipe them on the first day. And not only does it give you that, you know, good kind of buffer to fall back on, but it also kind of spooks people, I think, into almost defeat even before the rally's over, because, you know, even if he decides to back off or if he's slower, you know, it's in their heads at that stage that, sure, this guy could have, he's only driving 90% now when they're taking time back out of him or whatever. Like, he could turn around again and wipe us again. So it was,
I think it was kind of tactfully clever as well, because if you look at the changing nature on the stages from Friday to Sunday, Friday were a bit more forgiving, kind of, they weren't as flat out fast as the ones on Saturday. They were the soft sandy gravel. I know there was fog there, but any bit of commitment on Friday was going to pay off. So I can imagine him looking at that going, right, I'll probably get away with, if I go absolutely balls out here now Friday, I'll have more chance of getting away with it than I will on Saturday or Sunday.
Well, the road position as well, I think, definitely would have come into play for him as well. And I think if you look at how things panned out results-wise throughout the rally, there's certainly an argument to be said for that Pirelli was the tyre to be on in Argentina, assuming you picked the right version of it, because it was a Subaru versus Ford battle throughout the rally.
Yeah, I suppose it probably, with the conditions, probably favoured that, because everyone knows Pirellis are the stronger tyres in the wet. Well, many a time, right? But just wanted to, did they put more work into those colder weather conditions for tyres, you know? Yeah.
We've mentioned this before, like, it was another kind of interesting, I suppose, variable in what was going on at the time. You had that kind of difference in competitiveness across different surfaces and different weather conditions within the two brands of tyres. So, as I said, these sort of events generally tended to suit the Pirellis better than the Tarmac and the kind of, I suppose, the likes of Finland and things like that. They didn't seem to go quite as well on the really fast stuff. Even though, having said that, am I talking through my arse? I think I might be.
Yeah. Sorry, there's three of us here, don't worry.
That's all right, yeah. Surely one of us will be right. Surely. But
we all talk hoop here.
Yeah. But McRae, he was on the limit. He even said it himself. He was at 100%. You know, and McRae at 100% is really a sight to behold. He actually hit it. He was lucky enough to get away with it. He had a silly moment there, kind of a hairpin lift. The car went up in two wheels for a second or two, and as we see, you know, especially in these kind of events, slow, silly kind of square left or square right or a hairpin or whatever, you know, you can get caught in the ruts, and before you know it, the car's over. It happened to numerous people. It happened to Delacour on that's the first Friday morning stage, kilometer into the stage, he was on his roof, and the car, like, it wasn't damaged at all, really, just cosmetic. Smashed the windscreen and things like that.
Another classic WRC shot.
Pretty likes as well.
Likes as well later on the day. Yeah, just
got. They were quite lucky as well, because the engines were running upside down, and as anyone knows, that's not a good move sometimes.
No.
When the thing comes back down to earth, the oil is in the wrong areas, not the bottom end.
It's not as risky with those engines, but they all have the kind of the rollover valves in them anyway.
I don't know. Look, either way, it's not what you, it wouldn't be.
None of you.
Shall we say? But yeah, as I said, the main story with day one was McRae's just absolute attack. He was flying. I think was the quickest
six.
He lost time in stage seven. I'm not quite sure what happened there. Lost 17 seconds on stage seven, which is unusual. Signs actually was quickest in that stage, but come the end of the day, he was just let me check. He was over 40 seconds ahead of the second place guy, which is Burns. So Burns was having a good run as well, which was encouraging to see. But still, 40 seconds, fair old chunk of time to lose on the first day, you know.
Richard had a spin, I believe. I don't know, was it in the fog? I think he kind of attributed 20 seconds of loss to that. But I mean,
yeah,
I would imagine they'd have both had fairly close road position. You know, there wouldn't have been a massive difference in road position between them.
Yeah.
But again, you'd have expected that charge from Burns with his traditional speed in the fog. But again, what stage did he have the spin on?
I think it was on the first two, on the first, well, three or four.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no, I thought he spun. He was in fourth when he spun. I
don't think road position in Argentina would affect people as much as it might do on the other kind of gravel events. There doesn't seem to be as much of that kind of heavy coating of loose gravel on the surfaces you'd see in maybe the European events or in Australia or New Zealand or whatever. It was kind of a little bit more like feeling it was almost not damp, but it was a little bit kind of more compacted or something.
Yeah, it's almost the perfect time of year because it's cold enough and damp enough that the gravel's a bit wet and compacted, but it's not so wet that it's getting caught up and rutted.
It's their autumn, isn't it? Traditionally, when the event is held.
It's just coming into winter.
Yeah. So, that, as I said, that kind of equalizes things a small bit through the field. Big mention to Sainz. Sainz is in third. Which was some going. We hadn't actually mentioned it before the event, but he was in serious pain. I think he'd done something to his back in training prior to the event.
Sciatic nerve.
Was that what it was?
Yeah, because his leg was going into spasm, and he was getting physio for it.
Go away.
He trapped a nerve and it was going down his back and down, traveling down his leg, his right leg.
Jesus, tough.
Because you could see the stretches that he was doing at the side of the car. That's what you'd do.
Oh, okay.
Jeez, yeah, but even like it's another Sainz classic reliable result. But on top of that, you can see the pain in his face. With every interview, he has no interest in it. Yeah,
he looked like a man who was tired as well. You know, like you could see the physical exertion was taken out of him to set a fastest time on day one with that. That's some going.
Like, yeah. Sainz is an absolute legend. Like as you said, serious going. Like and. He probably wasn't sleeping in between legs or whatever with the pain of that. I don't know what actually caused it. I think it was mentioned just it was a training accident of some sort. I wouldn't doubt that in the slightest. Sainz was one of the hardest working guys. I'm sure that it was a legitimate to it in the case of he was falling off his bike again or something like that, like he did in 95 or whatever. So I think he's probably got a bit too sensible at this stage of his career to have that kind of issue hobbling him or whatever, but then we'd
you know what we never touched on as well at the start was this was Loic's 50th WRC rally.
50th?
Yeah.
Jeez, that's actually a lot, like, isn't it? When you think about it.
He'd been doing a bit in F2 though before. He'd had a Marlborough backed campaign, I think around 94 or 95 in
Astra.
Astra.
Regardless of the car, that's massive experience.
It's big. You're right. It is big experience. And then, as we said before, he was knocking around in Toyotas there for a bit, and then into the Lancer. But looking at the rest of the standings, Mackinnon was fourth. Again, another pretty decent drive. Probably a little bit disappointed, I'd say, not to be higher up. And Levinti was traditionally strong. And were we starting to see, you know, maybe the Lancer losing its edge? Hard to call, but
he was very lucky in one section where it was a right over crest into a left, I think it was fifth or sixth gear, and there was a spectator on the inside. Another example of the slightly questionable spectating habits, and he had to correct his line at the last second.
That was a big one, actually.
He was ridiculously lucky to get away with that.
Yeah, that was, he didn't, did you say he busted red, was it? No, that, I think yeah, that was day three, I think. Well, thanks for spoiling that. Well done.
No, there's a lot of damage. I don't care, I'll spoil everything.
Come on.
Bruce Willis was a ghost.
But yeah, so as I said, yeah, very, very lucky he was doing over the ton there, definitely. So a big moment. The Peugeots were not having a great rally again, some reliability issues. Robin Pera pace was pretty okay, but he had gearbox issues earlier on. It was something that actually kind of bugged the 206 for the I suppose its whole lifetime. They had issues with the hydraulics were controlling the diffs and the gear change and stuff like that, and if there was an issue with the pump or with whatever,
obviously that's pressure.
Sorry?
Weren't they just not beefy enough? Because even, wasn't there an issue when Peugeot brought the 207 with Breen over to Ireland and they kept bursting stuff in it when he was doing the Circuit of Kerry?
The 208, I remember that actually. Maybe they were on the limit of performance with some components, and you know they weren't quite at the durability aspect mightn't have been there, but
we'll speculate over a works team like Peugeot and their strategy about building cars.
Yeah, listen to us, like
water splash caught him out though, wasn't it?
It was he broke the suspension and then kind of got bogged in a water splash, and he ended up retiring, I think, not long after that. Yeah, you're right.
Argentinian retirement.
Yeah. Listen to us go on and try and tell Peugeot Sport.
Oh, yeah. That's it. We're sitting here like the architect in the Matrix, just going,
the definition of armchair fucking experts. But anyway.
Yeah. I hate myself now, Jesus. Yeah. Listen to me. I'll tell you what you should have done 20 years ago. Yeah.
But anyway, look, we can
but anyway, back to Peugeot and Grandhomme had terrible problems, didn't he?
He did, and Ariel was complaining about the altitude, something to do with oxygen.
Ariel complaining?
I know, not like him. He was a shout out as well as his sunglasses. He was wearing one of those kind of, it's a woolly hat, but it has flaps and also a peak. It was just
sports casual.
Was some bit of gear, no? I don't know where you'd even go about getting one of
hunting
them. Yeah, but but that was day one. I don't think there's anything else to note on day one.
Solberg was just having a steady day. That Solberg, came in seventh.
On that point about Solberg, Tommy, do you remember? I think on all of the days he didn't look at his times throughout any of the day until the end of the day, and it's probably think is the start of Solberg starting to properly mature.
Yeah.
Slowly but surely kind of going to get away from the mad speed that he had at the start.
He had a trouble start to the year, right? And you know, we saw in Catalonia even like there was talks to be had with him. They'd obviously come up with some bit of a improvement strategy for him. And this was part of it. But no, he was driving steadily.
I think Subaru really needed something out of this weekend as a team, not just from Burns, because Marco Martin was substituted for Toshi Arai for this weekend as well. And Toshi was lying in 11th, but you know, the change in approach from Solberg, like you say, William, is definitely reaping dividends already, you know.
I'm just looking at stage times here from the last stage of the day on the Friday, and without any, I suppose, you know, evident problems, it just gives you a demonstration of the spread in pace back then. Bruno Thierry was the quickest of the scorers, and he was 36.6 seconds off the fastest stage time without any sort of, you know, obvious problem or problem that was made apparent on the coverage or whatever, which is a fair loss.
Is it more of an indication though of the difference between the cars rather than the drivers?
Totally. Jeez, no, not saying anything against.
Against
Bruno, and even Ken Harrison there, another very quick guy in his day, was 53 seconds off the pace. Like, it's probably something that was more apparent back then. There definitely was a bigger gap in performance between the cars. I know we talk, you know, in recent times about the Citroen being slower than the other cars, but it wasn't to that, you know, level of time last procedure, and that there was still only a couple of seconds in it, but it was enough to make the difference, you know, rallying. And even go back to the Group B days, and it's actually funny to note, 1986 to 2001 is a shorter time period than 2001 to now, which is kind of depressing.
It's a frightening thing to look at. But
if you look at some of the stage times and the winning margins back then, there were minutes and minutes in some events, whereas now, you know yourself, there's seconds, sometimes even fractions of seconds in it, nearly just it. So
that's the depressing point, Moss, of the generation gap.
Yeah, let's not dwell too much on that.
I love, and I would point out, is the shot. I think it's probably why the way I see rallying is, Joe, out in the wilderness, rough and raw, kind of totally quiet, not the glitz and glamour of F1 or track racing, and you have a stage shot like Argentina, up in the mountains, lovely stage with kind of soft gravel, and you have a Skoda Octavia bouncing out through the stage.
Yeah,
like you can't get a better image than that. I guess it's probably the purest rallying image you could see. A big dog rough car going down alien stages.
Well, bouncing, I think, is a fairly accurate description for them on day one. They had both of them, ironically, had suspension issues, which for one of the most toughly built cars, I was kind of surprised by. But Schwartz
dragging the weight 2,000 meters above sea level, of course.
Probably would have got asthmatic too with the car as well.
Yeah.
So Thierry ended the day in 10th, and Schwartz ended the day in, I think he was in 14th, running around there at the end of the day.
Yeah, I'd say they would have been going in looking for a decent result. It was the first time they'd made the trip to South America as well, for the event. But as you said, the power last would have been exacerbated as well by the altitude, and everyone was suffering, but obviously the lower power cars were going to suffer that bit more again.
Some very high speed sections in the rally, like you see some of the camera shots there, and it's sixth gear sections there where they're carrying massive speed.
Yeah, especially in the lower kind of altitude areas, the kind of flatter sections of the stages, they're really, really quick, and they actually look like nice there just to drive. I'm not sure about the higher parts, like you said, William, with Aitken and stuff like that, I'd say they're just something you get through. But
that's what I'm saying. Like it's probably same with every kind of thing on TV and reality. Even something that looks a bit rough on TV, it's like, nah, it doesn't even come close to showing how rough it is.
I'd say so, yeah. But anyway, another thing to mention just before we move on to day two, Solberg was experimenting with some sort of chin strap goatee thing. Probably, yeah, around this era as well. You said I did the hangover from the 90s of pretty, you know, terrible fashion decisions. That beard, Jesus, man, that was
tempting. I want my IB Phantoms 2K album back as well,
yeah,
just so you know. All right, you've had it for long enough off me, Morris. Okay,
no, I've do you remember Euphoria? Do you remember Euphoria?
Which one?
Yeah, he's wearing it in the very bit. Is it the yellow one? The gold, Euphoria gold or something like that, inside one of the cars at the moment.
The green one, it's unreal.
Some bangers now on that one. But that was Solberg's beard. On to day two. Mäkinen was having issues with the transmission. So imagine, you know, a car that has issues with the transmission inherently when everything is working fine. But he broke a rear drive shaft. I don't know, just pop out or something like that. But
it was popping out of the rear diff, wasn't it?
He kind of defected into some sort of working condition again. But you could see like the car. I think it was the left rear that was giving him trouble, because right hand con was the orc is just understeering like a pig, and right and then left hand does then it's kind of doing what it should do until he gets it straight again, and it's just kind of snaking up the road again. The fact that he didn't lose more time than he did is kind of a testament to Tommy's talent, trying to drag a car around like that.
He used a jack and a rock to fix it, so it ties in with the Agri link with Valtra and the way that he managed to get around it as well. You know,
all he was missing was arc welding at midnight on a Friday in the pissing rain.
No, with no mask or nothing. Yeah.
No mask, yeah. Under the headlights of a Jeep.
Don't knock it. I fitted an alternator for an autocross one day under the headlights of a Focus, not even a Jeep. So,
Tommy, my first car was built under headlights.
Oh, yeah, and it wasn't apparent whatsoever. Yeah. The second car as well. That's it, was it?
It's the normal second car is wearing it. Even the rebuild.
Anyway, Aurel was having turbo trouble, so the Peugeot Gremlins had jumped over to his car at this point. And it's just an interesting thing to note, and we mentioned it earlier on in the episode about the kind of the bad vibe, the atmosphere, I suppose, with him and the team. He was very, very fast to blame the mechanics. He kind of suggested that it was something. No, I don't know. Was it the turbo itself, or was it a boost pipe fell off? I don't know. It wasn't cleared up, or wasn't clarified in the coverage. But it's just interesting to see how quick he was to, you know, apportion blame there, which is a little bit unusual to see. Yeah,
very kind of almost sore losery, like.
Yeah. Again, look, these guys are they're at the top of the sport. They've been paid handsomely to do the best they can. And anything that kind of handicaps them is going to be an issue for them. But again, you know, you don't pick your own either, like, you know.
That's interesting. You couldn't have his chief mechanic coming out after an event, giving out saying that Aurel crashed and he shouldn't have passed. You know what I mean? People, you know, as Tommy said there, it's a team sport, even though people don't think it is.
Yeah. No, totally. Like, you're trusting these guys to, especially this level, you know, to do the best job they can in the car and make sure the car is safe. Of course, more than anything, that someone hasn't forgotten to tighten the bolt somewhere, whatever. Like, you know, we're even the same with that ourselves, and we're competing. Like, you know, you're putting your hope and that everything is and the car is tight. But
yeah, well, that's it. Like, even though I said, like, kind of slag on my first one, I remember I was OCD about my car prep. They never looked nice, but I used to go to the absolute end of every nut and bolt, making sure everything was torqued and specced and right, because...
But then we'd have done lap on the back left and a Pirelli in the back right. So
that doesn't count, right? That was a sponsor issue.
Once in the car was sponsored by Pirelli, was that?
We had a budgetary disparity with the corporate sponsorship.
Okay. Was that like...
Or lack of it.
Was that like doing BAR and Lucky Strike on one side and 555?
That's exactly what it was. That's what I was going for now that you mentioned it.
Would you not have ran in front to back? No.
I couldn't afford a full set of four, and I bought two tires for the front, and the back had to do.
Yeah. I remember, about fucking, was it on our, no, it wasn't the first stage we did. It was second or third stage we spun. It was definitely because of the tire imbalance.
Oh, 100%. Was that in the stone throwers?
Because the stone throws. That was the radio. I was reading the notes, like Jean Paul Chiaroni as well. Because he's never. I had the two pages open the one time, but even does
that was the one. Yeah, we came over. I think it was like a four left, an innocuous corner. I was convinced you touched a bit of grass in the front, but it was definitely the back. And of course, we did it in front of all the lads. The embarrassment and shame was unbelievable. Yeah. I remember driving away thinking, fucking, I wish I rolled. It would be way cooler.
why didn't we put it off properly? But anyway, another big pointless tangent. So shout out there again to Daly.
Burns was keen to close the gap anyway to McRae. He made a different tyre choice and they were swapping times.
And the speed rolled up, Tommy.
He did. He meant business. The fastest times in the day went with 2 for McRae and 3 for Burns as the day went out. But
and they were swapping, like, all day, Tommy, like you said, weren't they? It was Burns, McRae, Burns, McRae, Burns.
Yeah, you were talking fractions of seconds, though. It was tit for tat, really, you know. But, like, I suppose that showed more kind of how close they were, because they were pulling away from everyone behind them.
Yeah, over the course of the day, when you added it all up, Burns only probably pulled back about 5 seconds from McRae. Yeah. So McRae was still, you know, he still had a decent lead going into the final day, 37.1 seconds. Sainz was still in third, which is, again, great throwing by him to some going to stay, even just be able to drive around with the back pain he was in. Salberg was up to fourth. Mackin was in fifth after his issues, and Granholm was in sixth. I think did Granholm have some other trouble? I know Salbrook had trouble with his gearbox. He lost 4 to 6 gear towards the end of the day. So
Granholm's problem was that he just didn't give a shit anymore.
He was struggling with he had problems with the diffs and the power steering. Was what Granholm had during the day.
You're right. Yeah, he was struggling for pace. Time on that. Yeah, just a couple of interesting issues on day two. Both kind of the same team. McRae's car, the back of it caught fire. I think, I don't know, it was the exhaust rubbing on the bodywork or something like that, but it went up pretty quick, but he stopped up and got it put out quick enough, in fairness to him, and got it back to service or whatever.
Alistair
McRae's one,
wasn't it?
Alistair McRae's one, yeah.
Ericsson had the same thing, didn't he?
Did Ericsson go up as well?
Well, Ericsson didn't fire, Ericsson kept going. He just got a bit of smoke. It must have been the same thing.
But another thing, kind of a bit of an unfortunate event, incident. So Spectator's Barbecue kind of got out of control and caused kind of a bit of a bushfire, which actually ended up engulfing like 20 Spectator's cars, which is pretty big. And, you know, obviously got out of control very fast. But there was to be a kind of an unfortunate sight there as well. There was no one injured in the fire, thankfully, but inside in service, they'd heard about it and they'd sent out a couple of crews to respond to it, and one of them was a water tanker. So, and there's actually footage of this in the coverage, which is pretty scary to watch. So the cars were queued up at the time control or whatever, and the two Skodas were one after the other. And whatever way, the guy in the water tanker just kind of a 90-degree right-hander or whatever. Yeah, it was going way too fast, and the orcas went over. I actually ended up landing down on top of Bruno Thierry's car, but unfortunately, one of the Skoda management was nearby, and he actually got a belt to the truck as well. Unfortunately, he was fairly seriously injured. He recovered after, but Jens Pullman, that's the guy, yeah. But and Bruno was actually in the car when the tanker came down on top of him. He said in the coverage he was lucky he didn't have the belts on, because he was able to kind of duck out of the way when this thing came on. So he was very fortunate, but that was kind of a very, very sad and strange end to the event for the Skodas. The two cars were pretty seriously damaged, and obviously their team member in a serious condition as well, so they packed up and headed away. But lucky enough, no one was killed in that. But Jesus, what a thing to happen! Like,
it's just mad when you have the footage of it. I think it's just, if you heard the story, be like, Jesus, that's mad. It's a bit weird, but the raw.
But it was a shocking then to see it as it is now.
Yeah. Your man just come absolutely lit into a square right in a truck full of water.
Yeah, and over she went. But look, as I said, thankfully there was nothing too serious came out of it. So,
something as well. Actually, there was bringing it up. Lloyds and Delacour were in a very close battle. Ironically, for the two guys that had both rolled on day one, they seemed to be swapping times tit for tat. But Delacour went on a big push. But interestingly, it seems to be a recurring thing with the Focus, that the same thing that caused McRae the problem in Monte Carlo and caused Delacour a problem occurred again, the fly-by-wire throttle.
I would hate to be on that design team in Emsworth when that happened.
Were you on the design team, actually? could this be the explanation for everything?
I said I would have hated it.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I just got that. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well done. Come in. But as you said, yeah, not a nice issue to be facing into again. As I said, there was questions being asked, but day three then. Nothing. It was kind of unusual. This rally, McRae was definitely the dominant guy. He'd put in. He had, like, there's no questioning his pace throughout the start of the year, on pretty much every event. Even including the Monte, obviously Catalonia was not the strongest. That was more a factor of the tires and the car rather than him, obviously. But this was
different. Just on that, Mars, as you're looking kind of ahead into day three, just something I noticed, I was actually looking back over results and things. And obviously day three was all about the sting in the tail with the rally finishing with Mina Clavero and El Condor. The rest of the day was just kind of a job, get through the day. Shortest amount of mileage, you know, 118 kilometres. With Burns on a charge, he was kind of saying that, look, I'm pretty sure I can't catch him. I'm just hoping something will go wrong either with the car or he'll do something stupid. But could you imagine Burns going into day three knowing that, like, you'd 118 kilometres, he was 37 seconds behind. He would have to be making up 0.3 seconds per kilometre to beat McRae.
Yeah.
Getting a hope, like.
To make up any time in McRae is a hard test, let alone that amount. But, you know, Burns, yeah,
just looking at it, and I was looking at it going, Jesus, 0.3 seconds a kilometre on those types of roads.
Yeah.
Especially going into the last two.
I think what's very impressive about McRae's performance as well is that he managed it from the front.
Yeah.
But got that's the lead and managed it. And it kind of goes against the school of thought of, you know, here's the fella who just leaves the brain out. He managed the lead from the front and going into the final day with still with the lead, was able to manage it running first on the road as well.
But that's why I reckon I made the point at the start, Tommy, about it was very strategically done to go absolutely balls out day one, see what kind of lead you have, and all you have to do is manage it. Because like we went through day two, they were splitting times. I think Burns gained maybe 5 over the whole day.
Yeah.
So McRae, that's what I'm saying, McRae had the rally won on Friday. Yeah. Fair enough, Burns had the 20 seconds lost, which was obviously playing into McRae's hands a lot.
Yeah.
No, Nothing happened Saturday, into Sunday, just maintained it, and that was it.
It was a different McRae to the one, you know, in the years previous where McRae had been in similar situations. He'd had dominant leads in rallies and thrown them away because of silly mistakes.
Yeah. I'd say it was an embarrassed McRae, to be honest.
When there was no one... when there was no need to be pushing as hard as he was in those cases, but this was definitely a mature drive, and as you said, he doesn't get the credit that he deserves for these kind of drives. You know, everyone remembers the Colin, you know, four wheels locked 45 degrees down the road into a junction kind of cracked, like, and you know, rightly
so. This is equally as impressive.
Yeah, no, he could be very, very strategic minded when he wanted to be. And as I said, he's won Safari numerous times. You don't win the Safari by just going flat out all the time. It's just not possible. So I think, is it 3 times? No, he's won the Safari 4 times, isn't it? Yeah, 97, 99. 2002. 2001, 2000. No, he didn't win 2001. 3 times. Sorry, my bad.
Yeah.
But anyway, look, the point still stands. He was well capable of these kind of drives when it suited him, so no, fair play to him. And it was definitely the kind of result you needed at this stage in the season to kickstart things. You know, it was a good confidence boost for the team.
They both needed it. McRae and Burns both needed it.
They did, totally, yeah. Burns, as I said, in second. Like, not much really happened on day three in terms of, you know, position changes, which for the year it was unusual enough when you think about it. You know, it was in a lot of rallies there was a lots of nip and tuck going on, but not in this case. Signs,
didn't you have
Solberg and McInnen?
Yeah, Solberg and McInnen, that turned out to be more entertaining, really.
Yeah, yeah, it's true, actually. Sorry, McInnen wound up 4th again. Signs was in 3rd, great drive just to bring the York home. Again, you didn't really hear much from him all rally, bear, you know, the fact that he was battling away with the pain. But fair play to him, he got through with it and more points on the board. Kind of crept closer to McInnes leading the championship again, so great performance by him.
I'd love to have been supplying oil coolers and radiators on the final day. I would have made a killing.
Oh, yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
Everyone seemed to have done some bit of damage with that. McInnen, Kenneth Erickson, Granholm, they all seemed to do damage. And there was a clip in the footage where it was like a jump into a dip, that they all seem to be taking a chunk out of the car on the front splitter.
Delacour actually took it the best of them.
They were hitting the nose of the car on the rise of the dip, we'll say. The angle was all wrong. But yeah, McInnen was lucky to stay going, actually. He as I said, cracked the oil cooler and possibly the red as well, because he was losing oil and water, and you could see it dripping out from under the car, which is... generally, no.
It's not great.
No,
it's not
no, the oil and water generally tend to work better when they're inside in the places they should be, as opposed to on the floor under the car.
Risto didn't donate his sock or his balaclava to stuff that, you know, to hold it either. I noticed that. That's very selfish, no, I thought.
Have you done that before, Tommy? You have?
No one had to donate the odd thing there for that kind of leak.
Good man.
Sacrifice, you know.
Yeah. But anyway. Yeah, so that was the event, really. That's another, you know, interesting event. As we said, McRae, a very important event for McRae and Burns to get their first kind of big scores up on the board. I know Burns had points in Portugal and stuff like that, but no, definitely it marked the turnaround in their fortunes, and they kind of gave McRae a good boost going into this section of the season. Events he'd always traditionally been very strong on, and Burns as well. So just looking at the driver standings after this, again, McInnen was still in the lead. He was chalking up scores to add to his 2 wins early in the season. Sainz in second, purely based on consistency. Sainz, I don't think Sainz won a rally this year, but he was still there or thereabouts. At the end, he was still in with a chance at the title in the last round, which just speaks volumes for the guy, like, in his approach. You had McRae, Orrell and Rovan Pera all tied on 10 points in, one win apiece. That was their only scores from the season so far, and Burns in behind after the strong showing here and the points in Portugal. So, and in the manufacturer standings, you had Mitsubishi leading Ford, Peugeot in third, even though Peugeot didn't get any actual points on the board on this event, even manufacturer points from what I can see.
Or he retired.
He pulled the wheel off, didn't he?
Yeah.
And
tried to his misery.
Subaru then, Hyundai and Skoda. So, yeah, interesting event. Just kind of, as we said, textbook McRae drive, just destroy them all on the first day and control the rally from there. So, fair play to them. And some spectacular action from the stages. And again, you made a point, Tommy, just comparing the entry from this year to last year, I think, and just the difference in terms of the finishes and things like that.
Well, I suppose you had 65 entries in 2001. I suppose to contrast that with 2019, there was 25 entries. Of the 65 cars that started in 2001, 15 of them were works cars. Like, in 2019, there was 25 cars started, 10 of them were works. And, you know, you're without trying to run down kind of how things are, we've made progress in some regards, but, you know, you do like to see a bit of quantity and things. Like, one of the most impressive things for me in this, watching this and looking back at results of it, Class N1, which would be the very showroom, very basic cars, there was three cars started that. Three Suzuki Swift 1.3 16 valves.
GTIs, so are they?
Yeah, GTIs. All three of them finished. No Super Rally. They all finished. No, there were the three cars at the back of the rally, but they all finished the rally.
First to finish.
Exactly.
They're cracking it, look, actually, Swift GTIs. Jeez, they're lovely.
They're brilliant jokes, eh?
But, like, Super Rally nowadays, like, there's 21 finishers in 2019, but 8 of them were due to Super Rally. In 2001, you had 32 finishers. And the distances were actually quite similar. I know, William, you brought it up in some of our recent podcasts about whether did that sound a bit right or wrong with some of the distances of them. It was only last year's event was only 40 kilometers shorter than the 2001 event. But I think you're not seeing quite as much local participation in the events because the N4 classes versus the R5, like 31 cars started in N4, for example, in 2001. You had 9 R5 cars turned up in 2019. You know,
but so, you wonder, Tommy, just on that point with the local entries, like it's not like back then. You go back to 2001, you say N1, it's not N1 or even Group N. Like costs were still relative. I mean, like factoring in, we all over the years, 20 years ago, inflation, all that kind of jazz, and all the financial aspect of it. Like, it was still as expensive, relative.
It's definitely cheaper running an Evo, Group N Evo, than it is to run an R5 car.
No, it is now. But when Group N's were the fun car at the time, it was still, I'd say, relatively the same cost. Because you have to look at, say, when those cars, we take a Group N Evo 7, 8, whatever, or 5 or 6, when that was the newest car out.
Yeah.
For amateur competitors, I'd like to see a direct comparison showing, let's say you factor in 20 years worth of financial change and inflation, all that kind of jazz, what the comparison is of running costs.
I don't think
there's a massive difference, because everyone talks about, oh, it's cheaper group end. Yeah, because the cars are 10-15 years old now.
Yeah, it's a good point, especially fuel would be a huge one, depending if you're running on pump fuel or rail fuel or whatever, you know, ourselves.
Consumption is the consumption of a group end car is quite high. I can tell you that from calculations that you see, and price per barrel, it is very, very high. But equally, you'd imagine for an R5 it is as well. But I suppose it's just interesting to see those trends of where, you know,
it is worrying. Like, support. You know, if you, like last year, there you 40% of your entry is Wox manufacturer or top level cars, which, you know, as a percentage sounds great until you realize it's only 10 cars. Yeah. As you said, you don't have the same level of support from local guys down the field in the lower rungs, lower classes. And it's the same, and it seems to be kind of not the same in any non-European event, really. At these days, you do get a lot of kind of domestic entries in the European events. You don't so much, as I said, Argentina, Mexico, even the likes of Australia, does generally a fairly slack entry following the main field. So,
but Australia has suffered domestically, I believe, anyway, in their own rally scene in terms of, I think, CAMS, that run motorsport in Australia, they've had issues in terms of what direction rallying is to go, and I suppose it's such a spread out country too.
Yeah.
For people to compete in as well, you know.
If you look at, like, over the years of how popular the Asia Pacific Championship was compared to now, it's pretty much non-existent. Like.
It's pretty much decimated now, right? Yeah. Again, you know, rallying is never cheap. To especially to be competitive. But it's definitely gone beyond the reach of a lot of people at this stage, more so than it would have done in the past, for various reasons, and especially here at home. Without getting too deep into it now, because we could be here for fucking 2 weeks discussing.
We could turn this into a wake. We could, you know.
We could.
I think we do an episode purely dedicated to insurance.
No.
Does enough negative news find around tomorrow without us adding to it? With the situation now, traveling and stuff at the moment. Look,
no, I'm talking on a grand scale, not just motorsport.
Yeah. But anyway, look, the I suppose we won't solve it. But look, without getting too deep into it, we're trying to provide a happy escape for people.
Really? Are we?
Yeah. I don't know if we've achieved too much of that this week, for sure. Look, we'll give it a go anyway. But anyway, that pretty much wraps us up for this episode. Anything you want to, guys, in terms of any other business? Or
one last point for anyone, if we've sparked anyone's memory by talking about it, go onto YouTube and just type in WRC Argentina 2001, and you'll get two brilliant onboards, one of Richard Burns on stage 14 and one of McRae on stage 19. The one of Burns is just, I don't know what it is, maybe it's just the lighting or whatever it is with the sun in Argentina, but the onboards are just so nice to watch.
Yeah. The onboards back then were better to watch than now, because
they're better, just, anyway, yeah.
Because you didn't have as much, you know, I suppose, cage or the big seats. The seats weren't as advanced as they are now, so you had...
The big fact is that they don't mount the cameras in the driver's jacket pocket on the back floor of the car.
Yeah.
They actually aim for the windscreen.
Yeah. You get the very odd onboard these days that does give the sensation of speed. There was one I watched recently, it was Latvala in 2014 in Catalonia, and the camera was just below the windscreen, as in below the top of the windscreen where the rear view mirror might be or whatever. And that gave, you couldn't see what Lafferty was doing or whatever, which is unfortunate, but it gave a proper sensation of speed. But unfortunately, that's pretty rare now at this stage. Back then, they definitely had, they had more, I suppose, options to work with as well, because the insides of the cars weren't as cluttered in terms of the cage or the seats or whatever. So that's just, again, something that's changed. We have to just go with the way things go.
Yeah, I reckon that's not down to car design. I reckon that's down to I'd say teams just don't want it.
You think?
For sure. Like, this is actually, John, trying your tinfoil hat.
I was just going to say, I'm hearing
they're calling the shots. Calling the shots. It's not the sport; they call the shots.
No, it's a simple thing. Like, why would you want perfect camera footage of your car through an entire stage where you can almost analyze and monitor the likes of steering angle, brake position, throttle position, where you can see all that? There's a lot you can interpret from an onboard.
Oh, we're through the looking glass here, people.
Tinfoil hat off. I'm going to join that Mast Watch Ireland page on Facebook.
Oh, please don't. Good God. Oh, my God.
I suppose it's good to let people know as well that we are working hard at trying to get this up on Spotify so we can pollute you a bit more. And also iTunes, we're doing our best to try and get on there. there's just little bits of criteria we just have to finish off with that, but we are working hard to get on those for you.
Several pending court cases to solve first, is it?
That's it, yeah. All our time in between recordings is taking up with
my recordings are being made from a remote island that I'm not at liberty to say where it is.
Yeah, it'd be like all those old podcasts we're doing a recording from. This is a collect call from Penn State Prison.
Yeah, Tommy's secret location, just off the M7, about 3 miles.
Can triangulate up there, guys, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway. So, yeah, as I said, that pretty much wraps us up. Thanks again for listening to us. We kind of lost the run of ourselves slightly here, but hopefully you enjoyed the look at kind of, I suppose, the comparison between the modern day and olden times again, as well as the analysis of the event itself. We're going to Cyprus next. Obviously not traveling there. We're going there via the medium of podcast. Cyprus, the slowest event of the season, but still an interesting one. Yeah, so that's us for this week. As I said, Cyprus now next week, and hopefully you're finding the podcast as interesting as we are to do. Hopefully it's giving you a small bit of extra information about the time and several other mad tangents that we seem to go off on. Sorry again to Dave Daly, but yeah. And he just have to get over it. But yeah, that's
tune in next week for Daly's daily
diversion.
Dilemma. Yeah, we make it a dilemma next week. Oh god. Anyway.
Triple D.
Yeah. But anyway. Yeah, we'll be getting a lot of hate mail. Let him know if you don't.
Just let that be a word of warning for anyone else who has negative feedback.
Yeah, absolutely. We won't like, you know, get into a troll bar with you. We'll just mention you.
You'd swear anyone was listening to us, lads.
You'll feature heavily in the
yeah. Podcast. No, literally tens of people are listening, Tommy.
Yeah.
So anyway, so that's us for this week. As I said, we'll talk to you next week. So stay safe and talk to you then.
See you guys.
See ya.